from Dallas to Kabul, JFK then and now. It's Friday, November 22nd. This is The World. 50 years ago, the headlines, a coup in South Vietnam, independence for Kenya, and then from Dallas, a news bulletin. The death of JFK affected people everywhere. For example, in Ethiopia.
Neighbors were coming to the Peace Corps volunteers' homes with food, with sympathy. It was amazing, the sense of a nationwide mourning and then an Africa-wide mourning and then worldwide mourning for John Kennedy.
50 years on, he is history for young South African students.
John F. Kennedy was the president of America. I don't know which one, the first or the last, but he was famous.
Kennedy and the world after the news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. November 22nd, 1963. My family lived in New York City. I wasn't even three, but it's my earliest memory. Okay, more of a sensation. I'm standing in front of the TV, halfway into my snowsuit. We never had the TV on in the middle of the day. Mom's in back of me, holding the zipper halfway up my little chest. But she's not zipping me up. She is frozen. She isn't speaking. And I remember struggling to see her face to get her attention, to find out why she wasn't responding to me. I've never forgotten that sensation of shock. Here's my mom with the details I can't recall.
You and your sister were already basically bundled up when the phone rang and somebody said, turn on your television, which is what I did. And that's when I sort of froze and almost forgot the two of you were there beginning to get overheated. So I felt we needed to get out, but I really didn't obviously want to leave. So I took my walk with you two around several blocks where there were cafes, one I remember clearly on Irving Place. I think it was 19th or 18th Street somewhere. And you could see through the window of the television screen. But, of course, there was no sound, so all I got was images. And they were pretty harrowing. So I made it the shortest walk ever, probably, for you guys, because I just wanted to get home.
If you were alive, even as a three-year-old, there's a good chance you know where you were when JFK was shot 50 years ago. Former Pennsylvania Senator Harris Wofford was in Ethiopia.
At the foot of Ntoto Mountain in Addis Ababa, as a Peace Corps director and the Peace Corps representative to Africa, south of the Sahara.
Harris Wofford had been tapped by Kennedy to be the architect of the Peace Corps. He had worked on JFK's presidential campaign and also served as his special assistant on civil rights. But in November 1963, Wofford was in Ethiopia managing Peace Corps operations across Africa. And in the wake of the assassination, Wofford says Africans seemed to be in mourning with Americans.
Neighbors were coming to the Peace Corps volunteers' homes, houses or rooms, with food, with sympathy. It was amazing, the sense of, you know, a nationwide mourning and then an Africa-wide mourning. And then one realized, the Peace Corps particularly from all over the world, realized it was worldwide mourning for John Kennedy.
What was it about JFK that seemed to seduce a lot of Africans? What did they like about him all over the continent?
You know, I think they had learned enough about America over their history to have a hope that America was going to be optimistic, young, idealistic, can-do. There was a waiting for America to be represented by somebody that embodied youth and optimism and idealism.
Did you ever find yourself on the defensive with Africans who said, where are the rights for blacks in your country?
By then, the Kennedy strong speech and the bill asking for full civil rights was top of the agenda. By the time he was killed, anyone who was following events in America had heard that, you know, the March on Washington was this tremendous success and that the president was pleased with it. It would not have been if he had not already taken the big step of sending the Civil Rights Bill up and given a talk that was used by Voice of America and every other form of communication to say that we were on the way to full civil rights in America.
Did you see Peace Corps as kind of a key part of JFK's foreign policy?
Well, yes, but the title of this show, The World, is the key, I think, to understanding John Kennedy, that his primary interest always was the world. That's why he responded. That's why extemporaneously he asked questions at the University of Michigan. Would you be willing to go and spend some years of your life in Goner, as he pronounced it?
Goner.
And he had about 5 rhetorical questions at 2 a.m. in the morning. It was in his mind and in his head. He didn't propose a Peace Corps. In some sense, the students there are taking a scroll around, 1,000 of them almost, signing, saying, yes, we would go if you form a volunteer corps. And he, hearing that, he turned to Sorensen, his speechwriter, and said, let's make a major speech proposing a Peace Corps, which they did in the Cow Palace of San Francisco. Yes, he saw the Peace Corps as a lot of different things, a Swiss knife with lots of different values. But I think the greatest value he had in it was reflected by what he said to me when I left the White House to go to Africa. He had just sworn in 300 Peace Corps teachers going to Ethiopia and another 500 going elsewhere who trained in Washington. And on the way in, he said, now this is Labor Day 1962. He said, you know, this Peace Corps is going to be really serious when it's 100,000 a year. And then in one decade, we'll have 1 million Americans who will have had firsthand experience serving in Asia, Africa, and Latin America.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. You called it.
And then at last, we'll have an intelligent foreign policy because there'd be a big constituency of people who understand the world.
Well, it's interesting because you referred to the Swiss Army knife metaphor. I mean, one blade in that knife that many say existed was, you know, put Peace Corps out there. It's a way of putting U.S. ideals out there into even the smallest villages in the world. When you were in Africa, did you feel you were kind of marketing the U.S.? To counter Soviet communist influence?
I think most Peace Corps volunteers and I tried to make it clear that that's not what we were doing. We were the first thing you learn, I think, as a Peace Corps volunteer is you better make it clear you're not there to either sell America or to make a country line up with America in the Cold War. You need to make clear that you're there to learn a lot and to contribute what you can. And I think the view of the Peace Corps as an engine of the Cold War was not a view that Peace Corps volunteers in those years wanted it to be. And it's not what the president, in his message, one of the strongest things he said, says not to be part of the Cold War, not to do this because it's right and it's necessary and the world needs lifting up.
Harris Wofford, for you, what is the most important legacy, the one thing that JFK left behind?
I think the Peace Corps is the embodiment, the only embodiment of the ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And he had already set in motion the creating of a domestic Peace Corps, which became VISTA in the War on Poverty. And for you and me, at least, out of the Peace Corps world, I would say that the Peace Corps and then National Service as turning that ask not into reality are very great things that he did. And he went to Dallas happy because on both the track of civil rights and the track of our relationship with the world, because the day before the civil rights speech he had given in June this great speech at American University, trying to show the way out of the Cold War toward world peace and nuclear control.
Former Senator Harris Wofford was a special assistant to President Kennedy and served as the Peace Corps special representative to Africa. He was associate director of the Peace Corps and based in Ethiopia when JFK was killed 50 years ago today. Harris Wofford, thank you so much.
Glad to talk to you.
When President Kennedy was elected, I was about 8 and a half or so. There was a lot of jubilation, even as a place as far away as Afghanistan.
Mo Kayomi grew up in Kabul, and Kennedy's Peace Corps made a big impression on him.
We had a great Peace Corps teacher. Her name was Ms. Holland. She was from New Hampshire, I believe. I remember when she came in, by that time we had already studied some English, and having that New England accent and not pronouncing the R's very strongly was a shock to us, that, well, there are different accents of English. She really helped me tremendously and was very encouraging to me. And she gave me a copy of the Profiles of Courage. It really inspired me, and it really gave me, even at a very young age, a deep appreciation of the values and the aspirations that President Kennedy was working on. In Afghanistan, the November timeframe, that was when we had our exams. And I was standing in the courtyard talking to one of my classmates, and then another classmate came over and said, did you all hear that President Kennedy was shot? And there was a sense of dismay and a sense of disbelief. And for a moment, all three of us were, you know, standing still and didn't know what to say. Getting a newspaper, I remember in those two or three days in Kabul, was almost an impossibility. And you really see people line up in the streets to get a copy of the newspaper. There was a deep sense of curiosity as to what has really happened. The predominant theories for many people was very straightforward and simple. The Soviets were behind this. That basically is what has happened. There are several legacies that he left, and one of the legacies that very few people know, and this is, of course, at the height of the Cold War, when the Soviets were trying to invest on the educational side of some of the countries. President Kennedy got quite interested on such an investment in Afghanistan, in developing an engineering and then later an agriculture college in Kabul University. And when I finished high school, I spent about a semester in that college before I went to the American University of Beirut. The impact of that and the caliber of that program was tremendous. Even to date, that college is still there and it's graduating many students. A good number of those people ended up becoming leaders of the country, and some of them are even leaders of the country today.
That was Mo Kayomi with Memories of JFK from Kabul. Kayomi is now president of San Jose State University in California. 50 years ago this Sunday, the BBC's America Watcher, Alistair Cook, spoke to people in Britain from a microphone in New York.
By now, it may well be impossible to add any sensible or proper words to all the millions that have been written and spoken about the life and cruel death of John F. Kennedy. Let me remind you of a sentence in his inaugural address.
Cook spoke about Kennedy's youthfulness. He reminded people that so many of the promises from JFK's inaugural address had not been fulfilled.
If we pause and run over the record of the very slow translation of these ideals into law, the hairbreadth defeat of the Medical Care for the Aged plan, the shelving after a year of strenuous labor of the tax bill, the perilous reluctance of the Congress to tame the Negro Revolution now with a civil rights law. We have to admit that the clear trumpet sound of the Kennedy inaugural has been sadly soured down three short years.
Alistair Cook told Britons that Americans were going through a special kind of grief.
Today, millions of Americans are baffled by the feeling, which seems to have little to do with their political loyalties, that they have lost a brother, the bright young brother that you're proud of, the one who went far and mingled with the great and had no side, no pomp, and in the worst moments, the Bay of Pigs, took all the blame, and in the best, the Cuban crisis, had the best sort of courage, which is the courage to face the worst and take a quiet stand.
The late Alistair Cook speaking to people in the UK about John F. Kennedy on Sunday, November 24th, 1963. Throughout the show today, we'll be playing music that filled airwaves around the world in 1963. This is the Brazilian guitar duo Los Indios Tabajaras and their song Maria Elena. This is PRI.
The the World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association. November is Diabetes Awareness Month. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com and by Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's 2 weeks since Typhoon Haiyan struck the Philippines, and we're still hearing news stories of terrible loss and suffering. Today, the official death toll shot up to more than 5,000 people. Another 1,200 people are still missing. Haiyan hit other countries, too, like Palau, a series of tiny dots in the middle of the Western Pacific Ocean. Reporter Ari Daniel just got back from the region.
Palau's made up of 700 islands, and the northernmost island that settled, Kayango, was the hardest hit. The typhoon came very close on its movement, and so the people there just sort of had to weather the typhoon as it blew through. Here you can hear one girl that I spoke with in Palau talk about what that was like.
Kayango had a big typhoon.
And what was it like?
All the trees fell down, and the house all blew down.
So as she points out, the island was essentially leveled. I mean, there were a few buildings that managed to escape unscathed. The hospital had its roof blown off, but otherwise was okay. The Protestant church was all right, and there was a home that was okay. But all of the other houses were completely destroyed.
So that sounds pretty terrifying. How did people kind of make it through this typhoon?
I spoke with one woman who talked about the fact that when the typhoon began to gather steam, they moved into a bathroom. There were four families that hunkered down inside the most stable structure in their home made out of concrete, which was the bathroom. So they all crowded in there. Kids were sitting on their parents' laps waiting for the storm to pass. And when they finally did emerge several hours later, they looked at the incredible damage that the storm had caused.
The trees fell on our house, our kitchen. The water came into the island, so it was really deep. So we couldn't find any of our stuff. So.
Did you think about leaving Kayango before the typhoon came?
No. I didn't want to go because I'm from Kayango and I don't want to leave my place.
And Marco, the thoughts from this 21-year-old woman really echoed the thoughts of a couple of the other women I talked to as well. They just didn't want to leave. And here are the sentiments from another woman named Brengis who spoke through a translator.
If the typhoon comes, we'd rather be in our home, in our place, to face the typhoon consequences rather than being relocated to other places. So,
situate us with these people on the island of Kayango. I mean, these people you were speaking to, how close to the shore do they live?
Oh, the island of Kayango is really tiny. I think there are maybe like 40 people that live there total. Mm. So it's very small, and it's pretty remote from the main part of Palau.
So this seems really typical of these small islands all over the Pacific that have to deal with these typhoons and really just living right on the sea.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, they're incredibly vulnerable to whatever the sea kind of tosses up into their path.
What are they doing now? Where are they staying, these people of Kayango?
So after they realized that their island was completely devastated, the government relocated the people of Kayango onto the main part of Palau, and they're staying inside a community hall.
So these people have a new home, but it's not home. I mean, how long are they going to be in this temporary state?
One woman I spoke to said it could be up to a year before they move back while they wait for their home to be repaired, both by people from other parts of Palau and some of the folks that are from Kayango. But while they wait, it's a period of adjustment. I mean, they're dealing with it okay in some ways. I mean, here's one woman who described the community hall where they're staying.
We have a kitchen, two bedroom, one shower room. It's really enough for us. We are 20 people here, including our kids.
So she says that it's enough for them, but you could still see that it's taking a toll. The kids seem to be holding up better. One of the reasons they moved the families was so the kids could keep going to school. But the families there notice that it's completely different in the main part of Palau. It's busier. There's more traffic. They're worried that their kids might get hit by the cars that are in the streets. So there's a lot of adjustment that still needs to happen.
Huge consequences for the people of Palau. Ari Daniel, just back from Palau. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Marco.
Ari's reporting was made possible by a grant from Solutions Journalism Network. For the adventurous traveler, it's the trip of a lifetime. North Korea, it's one of the most closed nations on Earth, but it is possible to visit there as a tourist. That's how 85-year-old Merrill Newman was able to see North Korea firsthand. He was detained, though, on his way out of the country last month, and he's still being held there. I'm on the line now with Don Kirk. He covers Asia for the Christian Science Monitor. And Don, you've been to North Korea several times, but this is not the way any traveler wants their trip to end. What happened with Newman?
Well, he was grabbed off the plane. He was already on the plane. He'd already gone through customs and everything. And he figured, as would anybody else, that he was free, that he was home free, that he'd completed his trip and was on about to take off for Beijing. Well, they boarded the plane and took him off, apparently. This according to his son back in Palo Alto.
Well, I mean, Merrill is a Korean War vet, and some news reports have mentioned that this could have something to do with his detention. What does that add up to for you?
Well, he could have argued with him about how the Korean War ended. They keep on saying, telling their people that the Korean War armistice was actually a surrender by the U.S. and South Korea, and that North Korea scored a tremendous victory in the Korean War. So he could have had debates with his so-called minders or guys on that topic. But it seems to me if they were all that excited about that, they would have let him know long before he got on the plane. They didn't have to come off get on the plane to grab him and pull him out. They had plenty of chance to tell him that, you're spreading false propaganda and you can't leave. But instead they let him get on the plane, which is the great mystery.
Mm. But North Korea has detained Americans before. Can you give us some of the reasons that North Korea has given for these detentions?
Well, the most recent was Kenneth Bay, who's a Korean-American. Kenneth Bay was detained a number of months ago, sometime last year. He was on a short trip, a brief trip, in from the Chinese side to northeastern North Korea. And they nailed him, I think, it's believed, because he had some religious material in his computer. And he was spreading the doctrine, the Word of God, or trying to spread the Word of God among North Koreans. Of course, the Word of God is sacrilege in North Korea. The only gods they worship are the Kim Dynasty, the current leader, Kim Jong-un. People have been executed and imprisoned for worshiping Christianity secretly.
So, Don, I know you've got a couple of other theories about what could have happened with Merrill and the North Koreans. What other possibilities are there?
Well, my theories are totally off the top of my head. I've been to North Korea a number of times, as you point out, and we've always been warned don't take any towels or don't take any pictures that you might see on the wall. Don't take or sheets or blankets. Some people might be tempted to pack some of that stuff away. People would like to have those things as souvenirs. So maybe it's conceivable that a visitor could have taken them and they could have noticed this stuff was missing and rushed onto the plane to get it. That's one theory. The other theory is I've kind of joked on occasion, what if you're leaving North Korea and you get the idea of writing a great farewell insult to the regime, scrawling it on the wall or on the mirror? Would they yank you off the plane? Well, if they found out about it, if they happened to see it before your plane took off, they might. So I have those two theories about why they'd rush into a plane and yank somebody off. But that's not to say that this gentleman was at all involved in any such silly activities.
Don Kirk with the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, JFK's legacy among Latinos in Texas.
The regular person out there still has Kennedy on their little altar at home, along with the Virgen de Guadalupe. Still there.
And the singing nun who helped America heal.
People needed some hope, and it made people happy, and the nun singing the song made them happy.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Most everyone around in 1963 has a story of where they were on November 22nd. In Texas, a few hundred Mexican Americans recall where they were on November 21st. They were in Houston, and they were among the last people to meet with the president the night before he was killed. The World's Jason Margolis has our story.
Back in 1963, a group of Mexican Americans in Texas had a crazy idea. Let's invite the President of the United States to meet with us. Some said, maybe he'll come. After all, he owes us. In 1960, Latinos formed Viva Kennedy Clubs, and their support in Texas helped Kennedy narrowly carry the state in the presidential election that year. 3 years later, and to the surprise of Frank Orteaga, the president said yes. He'd come say thank you.
We had bets going on he would show. and the more the Secret Service folks started coming around and so on, you know, say, well, hey, maybe there's a chance, you know, that he's going to show. And lo and behold, you know, there he was.
Orteaga was and still is a member of LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens. It organized the evening with Kennedy 50 years ago at the Rice Hotel in Houston.
The feeling, well, maybe about the best word that I can think of is, it was electric. Some of the things that they did, reaching over to the players and the band and shaking their hand, and gee, he was like one of us. And he just mingled without any fear. There was no fear whatsoever. You know, it's a hi, how you doing, and et cetera. You know, just extremely friendly, extremely friendly.
It was about 20 minutes that they were there with us, but it's really one of the greatest 20 minutes of my life that I have ever experienced.
Lupe Fraga was a 27-year-old entrepreneur in Houston at the time.
So we waited and we waited, and finally they came down. They came down, and President Kennedy gave a 17-minute speech. Just really had the people just roaring and excited. And then Jackie speaks to the group in Spanish. And that really got the floor rocking.
Gee, it was sort of a suspense, you know, when she started speaking it, that, okay, I wonder where she's going to maybe bump her toe. It's beautiful. She completed her presentation in Spanish very well, and it's, you know, it was great. It was great.
Frank Orteaga says it also didn't hurt that the Kennedys were Catholic, like most Latinos. Kennedy was assassinated the day after he met with Orteaga and other Latinos in Houston. Orteaga says it was like a family member had died.
Goodness, you go to church, and, you know, we would light candles, you know, to him, and like we would normally do for our own.
A half century later, President Kennedy remains an icon in many Mexican-American homes with older residents. Jose Gutierrez teaches political science at the University of Texas in Arlington.
The regular person out there still has Kennedy on their little altar at home, along with the Virgen de Guadalupe. It's still there.
Gutierrez wasn't there the night before Kennedy was killed, but he volunteered with the Viva Kennedy Clubs as a Texas teenager in 1960. The clubs raised money through bake sales and dances, so people would have the $1.75 to pay their poll tax, common in the South back then. Gutierrez says most Mexican-Americans had never been motivated to pay before Kennedy.
You know, for a poor Mexican, they could buy a whole 100-pound bag of russet potatoes and feed the family for at least 2-3 weeks, as opposed to this, to vote for a fat 50-year-old white guy. So this was a real choice. You know, we're going to go vote for this guy because he seems to be like one of us, you know, even though his name was Kennedy.
And while Latinos celebrated Kennedy's election, many would become disappointed in the years that followed. Gutierrez says Kennedy didn't do much to help Mexican-Americans.
It's horrible to say, but the best thing that happened was that he did die, and Johnson then became a 180-degree different person, from an arch segregationist voting against every civil rights measure to being the champion next to Roosevelt of helping minorities.
Gutierrez doesn't know if Kennedy would have achieved as much as President Johnson did. That's the academic perspective. Many older Latinos, like Houston businessman Lupe Fraga, don't care about that.
Yes, he was not a very good person as far as getting legislation passed. But I think as a leader, Kennedy eventually would have done it. I think his heart was in the right place because we had felt people were not listening to us. But when he came to speak to us, we felt empowered. We trusted him. We believed in him. Kennedy that day really struck a chord. I often wonder, had he lived, you know, what our world would be like today.
For The World, I'm Jason Margolis, Houston.
Despite his incomplete tenure as president, JFK still managed to squeeze in well over a dozen foreign visits, And when he was killed, people around the world mourned, especially in places where Kennedy left a lasting mark, like England.
The unprecedented intensity of that wave of grief, mixed with something akin to despair, which swept over our people as the news of President Kennedy's assassination, was a measure of the extent to which we recognized what he had already accomplished, and of the high hopes that rode with him in a future that was not to be.
Queen Elizabeth spoke in 1965 at the unveiling of a memorial in honor of JFK in Runnymede, not far from Windsor Castle. The one-acre plot is now officially American soil. Just 5 months before his death, President Kennedy visited Prime Minister Harold Macmillan at his home in rural Sussex, just south of London. During that trip, JFK stopped at a tiny English village for a Sunday Mass. They're still talking about it 50 years later, as Christopher Worth reports from Forest Row.
Forest Row is one of those blink-and-you'll-miss-it kind of places. It's just a dot on the map in the middle of green forests and English farmland. But in the center of town, lifelong resident Harold Waters reads a plaque outside the village hall.
This stone commemorates a visit of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, 35th President of the United States of America, to Forest Row on Sunday, the 30th of June, 1963.
Now, just to set the scene here, Kennedy was en route back to Washington from visits to Germany and Ireland. He stopped in England for a quick meeting at the British Prime Minister's country estate named Birch Grove.
Premier Harold Macmillan only has 24 hours of the president's time and a lot to talk about.
And with such a tight schedule, Kennedy's visit to Forest Row's one and only Catholic church for Sunday service would have been brief, not much longer than the Mass itself. But Waters, who was 23 years old then, says it was a big deal for the village. He and his wife grabbed the new color camera they'd bought for their honeymoon and went out to watch the president's motorcade arrive.
There was several hundred people, I suppose, watching Kennedy come through. My wife was 5 months pregnant at the time with our first daughter. So we came down here and waited.
Right here where we're standing
right
now.
Right here where we're standing now on this corner. And eventually we saw the cars coming down the road. An unmarked police car at the front and two security cars and Kennedy's limousine.
And Waters was well positioned to see the president. He holds up a rare, crystal clear color photograph taken so close you can see the reflection of the crowd in the side of the car as Kennedy waves from inside.
I nipped across to the traffic island that's just over there. I had a word with a policeman and a security man. I said, can I take a picture of President Kennedy from here? Is that all right? And they said yes. So I stood there and I got the picture I wanted. It wasn't until he was assassinated that I realized that he'd only been 3 or 4 feet from me with no bulletproof glass or anything between us.
Indeed, the car was the same Lincoln Continental Kennedy was riding in when he was assassinated less than 5 months later. Down the road, Tony Lewin drives me to Our Lady of the Forest, the Catholic church where he caught a glimpse of Kennedy in 1963 when Lewin was a kid.
This is now approaching the church here.
Today, there's nothing but a dilapidated old building. The church closed years ago.
Trying to picture him being here is quite something. It's hard to believe.
Were you standing up here, just watching?
I was up there by the hedge, the other side of the road. Then they stopped, and he got out, and he went and shook hands with lots of people. And Kennedy was a bit of a hero. He was good-looking, he was glamorous, and, you know, everyone was amazed.
Amazed because even in Britain, Kennedy was the first American TV president.
Here now is the President of the United States speaking from the White House.
The age of television in American politics had arrived in a way that it hadn't in Britain.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. I speak to you tonight in a spirit of hope.
And these pictures were always beamed over to us. And, you know, we felt we knew Kennedy better than we knew the British Prime Minister.
Ewan Morgan is a professor of American history at University College London. He says unlike past U.S. presidents, Kennedy captured the imagination of the British people partly because he was a symbol for Britain's changing sense of itself in the post-war era.
We'd been led by men of a certain generation for many years, or people who came from certain backgrounds. And Kennedy was seen as somebody fresh, you know, he was young. And, of course, the Kennedys had some indefinable celebrity status, and their impact was incredible.
Before the year was over, Prime Minister McMillan would be out of office, Kennedy would be dead, and Morgan says the 1960s would go on to see a youth counterculture that would change the U.S. and Britain forever. For The World, I'm Christopher Wirth, Forest Row, England.
We've got the photos that Harold Waters took of Kennedy's visit to Forest Row, and it's really amazing how close he got. They're at PRI.org. Many in Israel felt like they had a special relationship with JFK, too. And after he died, American Jews from every state pitched in to build a Kennedy memorial in Israel. Reporter Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem tells the story.
Nearly everything in Israel is steeped in historical significance and symbolism. Every tree tells a story. To understand the significance of the Kennedy Memorial, you have to know the story of the millions of trees in the Jerusalem forest where the memorial stands.
The trees here are gift of man. They are not gift of nature. Every tree that you see here was hand-planted.
Avi Noam Binder was a former emissary in America of the Jewish National Fund. Starting in the early 1900s, Jews from around the world would donate money for trees to make the desert bloom and as a way of claiming lands for the Jewish state, eventually founded in 1948. In 1958, as a junior senator from Massachusetts, JFK addressed U.S. supporters of the Jewish National Fund and praised them for the tree planting.
This is what he said, I'm quoting, "What work could be more heartwarming or more enduring than the great forest at Israel. Your children and grandchildren, when they visit Israel, will find your monument."
And among those monumental trees is JFK's monument, too. It's 51 ribs of cement arching up into the shape of a tree trunk, 51 ribs for each American state and the District of Columbia. Inside is a bulb that flickers like a memorial candle, and each cement rib features an American state seal.
Commonwealth of Kentucky, Great Seal of the State of Kansas, Iowa.
The dedication ceremony of the monument, 3 years after Kennedy's assassination, made international news.
Jerusalem. On a hill outside the Holy City, a memorial to President Kennedy was dedicated by Mrs. Earl Warren, wife of the American Chief Justice. The U.S. National Jewish Fund financed this tribute to the great man who was so tragically stricken down. What better place than this could perpetuate his memory?
Some 2,000 people attended the event. And over the years, Henry Kissinger, Frank Sinatra, Sharon Stone, and a stream of American VIPs and Kennedy family members have all been at the site. But what used to be an essential stop on any American's itinerary isn't anymore. President Obama skipped the Kennedy Memorial on his trip here this year. Obama came to remind Israelis that, in his words, the U.S. will always have Israel's back. What many Israelis and Americans may not remember, though, says historian Shlomo Slonim, is that that policy began with JFK.
He was the first to supply anti-aircraft rockets, and this was very crucial in providing support and security for Israel against the possibility of Egyptian and Syrian aircraft attacking Israel at any future conflict. He was the first to say that the United States is committed to Israel's security and defense, and he proved it by his actions and his conduct.
Today, the imposing Kennedy Memorial is mostly a place where weekend hikers and cyclists finish their trails and take triumphant snapshots. 50 years after President Kennedy's assassination, his memorial and his legacy in Israel have become an indelible part of the scenery. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
We've got a lot more recollections of John F. Kennedy online, including those of a current generation of South African high school students. They know a few things about JFK.
He was born in Massachusetts.
They named the airport after him.
I think he dated Marilyn Monroe, or he had some kind of connection to her.
Watch that video from the Cape Town High School we've been following all year. That's at PRI.org/schoolyear. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. And by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We were just hearing how the rest of the world reacted to the Kennedy assassination, but now we're going to find out what was happening in the rest of the world at the time. Today, in the world that was, our history guy Chris Wolf is going to tell us. Chris, I was just checking out weather for that day. Warmer than usual in Boston, standard 45 degrees Fahrenheit in Paris, 53 degrees in Tokyo. What else was going on?
Well, Marco, you might be interested to know that November 22nd, 1963 was the first day that anyone anywhere in the world was rocking out to this.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always be true.
Yep, the Beatles' second album with the Beatles came out on that selfsame day in the UK. And then there was another giant cultural headline the following day, Saturday, November 23rd. That was the day that TV viewers in the UK for the first time heard this. Well, for non-geeks, that's the theme to the sci-fi classic Doctor Who, which at the very first episode aired the day after the Kennedy assassination. In fact, it was delayed by about a minute and a half because of the late-breaking news that were still updating about the aftermath of the assassination. And in fact, the BBC directors thought that so many people were probably listening to the news and watching what was going on that they actually repeated the first episode again the following week just to make sure they could reach the audience they were hoping to get.
Right, so that was television. What was on in the movie theaters?
Well, Liz Taylor and Richard Burton were dazzling in Cleopatra. Steve McQueen almost made it to freedom in The Great Escape. Tippi Hedren makes the terrible mistake of picking up some lovebirds in the Hitchcock classic, The Birds. In fact, it was a great year for the classics. The Longest Day, Lawrence of Arabia, Mutiny on the Bounty, To Kill a Mockingbird. Some listeners might also remember How the West Was Won and It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World. Some of these seem really dated right now. So I was surprised 1963 was also the first time US audiences heard this.
A theme song I recognize.
Yep, absolutely. The first Bond movie, Dr. No, was released in the US in May 1963. Now that's 7 months after it was released in the UK. There was no Pirate Bay back then.
Now, that's culture. What about the news? What was going on in the news before that news flash at midday here in the US?
Let's start with the obits. Two great writers died on that selfsame day. The daughter, Narnia, was closed with the death of C.S. Lewis, the author of Prince Caspian and all the Narnia classics. And fans of Aldous Huxley may be wondering what was going to happen to their brave new world as he passed away on the same time. The day before, the Birdman of Alcatraz, Robert Stroud, passed away. And then JFK himself was reeling from the news just a couple of weeks before with the murder of the South Vietnamese president, Ngo Dinh Diem, after he was ousted in a coup that JFK himself had, in a sense, approved of. The coup didn't help much. Vietnam was continuing its slide into chaos, and the US was in the midst of preparing to ramp up its participation in the war. In fact, 122 Americans died in Vietnam altogether in 1963.
You know, we're still living today through the major geopolitical trend that was the Arab Spring, which started in 2011. Politically, what was trending on this day in 63, to use the language of Twitter?
Well, of course, the Cold War was ever prevalent in the news. Civil rights, obviously, of huge importance within the United States and of huge interest to the rest of the world. But for most of the people, let's think about the people outside the United States. What they were principally concerned in, the biggest change in the world, was decolonization. Under U.S. pressure and from the pressure from colonial peoples, Britain, France, and other European powers were divesting themselves of the colonies they'd had for so long in Africa, Asia, and parts of the Americas. Algeria got its independence from France in July. Kenya and Zanzibar became independent a couple of weeks after the Kennedy assassination. Zambia and Malawi later in 64. My dad loved this age. He was a stamp collector, and so the first thing all these new countries do is issue new stamps. So he was very happy to be getting all these new countries issuing stamps and then reinventing themselves. Like Malaysia was created a few weeks before this, a union from newly independent states of Sabah, Sarawak, Singapore as well for a brief while, and then all the several states of Malaya. And so, yeah, Dad was in heaven.
What a heady time of history. Let's end on a notably happier note and bow out with that unforgettable Beatles album. Chris Wolf and The World That Was, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All my loving, all my loving, all my loving, I will send to you.
My months later, the Beatles would help put a skip back in America's step. Music has the power to do that, to distract, to pacify, to soothe. Nora Jones delivered the calming voice after 9/11. In 1963, right after JFK's death, it was also a female voice, a Belgian nun singing a song in French that became the number one song in the U.S. Dominique, Nique, Nique, s'en allait tout simplement. Oh Dieu, pauvre chantant. En tout chemin, en tout lieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu. Il ne parle que du bon Dieu.
That's what people needed at the time. Just something to enjoy without a lot of complications.
That's Deb Chadwick, author of the book, The Singing Nun Story.
People needed some hope, and it made people happy, and a nun singing the song made them happy. And, you know, people kind of saw the Kidneys as a Camelot. They really were planning on a bright future, and it was such a shock when he got assassinated. Anything simple and sweet, you know, people seem to really like.
The singing nun's real name was Jean-Paul Marie Deckers from Brussels. On stage, she went by Sœur Sourire, or Sister Smile. Dominique was recorded in 1961, but it didn't become a huge international hit until Kennedy's death. The song and the singer became cultural icons. In 1964, TV host Ed Sullivan visited the convent where the singing nun lived. And the following year, Debbie Reynolds starred in the movie The Singing Nun. Ed Sullivan himself had a cameo in that film.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight is the very special feature of this very special show. From Belgium, we are going to bring you the voice of a very dedicated young woman who composes and sings her own songs. So now, ladies and gentlemen, here is the singing nun.
Dominique, Nique, Nique, oh, Dominique charted Dominique, in 11 countries and topped the U.S. charts for 4 weeks. The song was translated into many languages, including Dutch, German, Hebrew, and Japanese. It wasn't just the melody that connected with people. There was something about the person the song was about, says Deb Chadwick.
It's about Dominique, the founder of the Dominicans, and talked about him traveling around the world, living in poverty, just trying to help people and serve God.
And Chadwick says listeners everywhere naturally linked the Spanish-born priest from the 13th century with President Kennedy.
You know, he wasn't afraid to stand up for what was right either, and that's very much like Dominique.
As for the singing nun, Jean-Paul Marie Deckers, we never heard from her again. She and her song really were of the moment. What a moment, though. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back on Monday.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Annenberg Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, GatesFoundation.org, the Carnegie Corporation, by the Henry Luce Foundation for Increased Understanding of East and Southeast Asia, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, MacFound.org. By the PRI Program Fund, supporting informed risk-taking in public radio programming, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nor Hall.
PRI, Public Radio International.